a black, gaping, charred hole in the front of their hotel where the lobby used to be.
The whole ideology behind the administration right now on their foreign policy has been one of using the fist rather than diplomacy to deal with other countries.
Rumsfeld has said that we're going to be rotating troops out, not rotating occupation troops, rotating combat troops.
The arrogance, the posturing of this administration is becoming more and more hollow as its lies become exposed.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Tuesday, August 5th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Desperately needed aid flowed toward Liberia's capital today as the arrival of West African peacekeeping troops brought a dramatic easing of 2 weeks of gun battles in the rebel besieged city. Nigerian troops began arriving yesterday at the vanguard of what will be a 3,250-strong force seeking to end 14 years of carnage and usher warlord-turned-president Charles Taylor into exile. The Nigerians, who concentrated on setting up defenses at the airport, had yet to be seen inside the city, but with guns stilled and expectations high, fighters on both sides waved at each other, hungry families emerged from homes to scour for food, and relief workers rushed supplies toward Monrovia. An American civilian delivering mail to the U.S. Army died today when his truck was blown apart by a remote-controlled bomb north of Tikrit, the military and his employer said. Also, angry residents of the city of Fallujah attacked an Iraqi police station for the second straight day, slightly injuring an American soldier who joined police in trying to fight off the attackers, who were armed with rocket-propelled grenades and automatic weapons. A car bomb ripped through a hotel in the capital of Indonesia today, killing 14 people and wounding 150 in the second major attack in that country in a year. Jakarta's governor says a suicide bomber probably caused the blast at the JW Marriott Hotel. Dan Murphy is a correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor living in Jakarta. He's the author of a three-part series entitled How Al-Qaeda Lit the Bali Fuse. He spoke with Peace Watch today following the deadly blast at the JW Marriott and described exactly what happened.
It seems about 12:30 or 12:45 today. The Marriott's a very popular hotel, and it has a very popular buffet lunch for a lot of executives in town, both foreign and Indonesian, that a small van got up into the lineup of cars coming into the semicircular driveway in front of the lobby and dropping people off there. You know, a town like this, a lot of people have drivers and get dropped off like that. And it seems as if he pulled in, and, almost immediately a bomb went off, you know, tearing a gaping hole in what was the lobby of the Marriott, you know, and killing a number of people, you know, mostly Indonesian taxi drivers and hotel workers that were around that part of the hotel.
Now, this is a JW Marriott hotel, which obviously is a U.S. company. Is this a hotel that many Americans tend to frequent?
It's certainly become associated with the American community in Jakarta. The U.S. Embassy has used it for a number of functions over the past year. That hotel's only been open, I think, since September of 2001, but the July 4th party for the U.S. Embassy was at the Marriott this year, which, you know, ironically had been moved there because it was deemed no longer safe to have those parties at the ambassador's house. A number of smaller U.S. Embassy briefings and seminars have been held at the hotel, you know, and certainly I think a number of American businessmen are staying there as well.
What kind of reaction has there been to this bombing there in Jakarta?
I think if you talk about on the streets of Jakarta, you know, you get a lot of very, very weary shakes of the head from people who just want this to end. I mean, many, many, many Indonesians are keenly aware that these types of events, which have unfortunately been happening with a fair deal of regularity in recent years, are damaging to the economy. They hurt, obviously the workers in the hotel. But more broadly, they contribute to an air of sort of despair, feeling that the country's having trouble putting its problems behind it. You know, so that would be the mood of average people you might speak to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, from the government, there's vows to bring the people responsible to justice, and I'm sure they'll have a credible and serious investigation into this.
Well, are there any early indications as to who might be responsible for the bomb at this stage of the game?
Yeah, I mean, everybody who's you know familiar with this and watching this, from you know the chief of police to leading politicians here to analysts, believes without knowing it, because there aren't a whole lot of details yet, but believes that an organization called the Jemaah Islamiyah was behind this attack, which had all the hallmarks of their past operations. They're the only people that have ever been known to use car bombs in Indonesia before. They've gone after soft targets where Westerners are known to congregate, you know, and they have an incredibly long list of grievances, you know, that's motivated, you know, all of the worst terror attacks in modern Indonesian history, including the nightclub bombings in Bali last October that killed over 200 people. This is not yet a fact, but it is a very strong suspicion, you know, and nobody has a number two suspect on their list.
Mm. This group, the Jemaah Islamiyah, is also reportedly acts as Al-Qaeda's franchise in Southeast Asia, does it not?
I think that's more or less correct. The group's leadership, by and large, either fought alongside the people who became Al-Qaeda against the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in the late 80s, or went and trained and were participated in the Afghan Civil War in the early 90s. And a couple of the key leaders of the group have maintained their ties with the Afghan Arabs ever since, particularly a man named Hambali, who's sort of the operations chief of the group and has been a wanted man in Asia for over 3 years now, you know, and remains at large. You know, there are a number of men on trial for the Bali bombings now, and trial testimony seems to indicate that, you know, some of the money that was used to pay for that attack came from Al-Qaeda.
And so Indonesia is the world's most populous Muslim country. How active are Al-Qaeda cells in Indonesia?
You know, if you look at terrorist acts, you know, like the one we had here today and, you know, the one we had in Bali last October, that's a fair deal of activity. You know, I don't know if we can call them out and out Al-Qaeda cells. I do believe this is a separate group that has very, very strong operational links to Al-Qaeda, but it's not the same thing. You know, yes, Indonesia is the world's most populous Muslim country. The vast, you know, overwhelming majority of folks, you know, obviously don't have any time for this type of behavior. The problem is, in a big country, that it only takes a very, very small group of people to do this sort of thing.
Mm. Did you actually go to the site where the bombing occurred, Dan?
Yes, I did.
Can you describe the scene for us?
You know, in some ways, I'm glad I got there maybe an hour and a half after the bombing took place, and so a lot of things I didn't see. But you know, there was a big black, you know, gaping, charred hole in the front of the hotel where the lobby used to be. I think almost everybody who was a victim of the violence had, you know, been taken to the hospital, to the morgue at that point. You know, I did visit one of the hospitals after I was there. And, you know, the only people I saw were the ones who, you know, whose injuries weren't sufficient to require immediate medical attention, because obviously the doctors were stretched. But, you know, to see, you know, a 25-year-old woman on a bloody gurney, you know, with bandages head to foot, who was just trying to, you know, eat lunch, is very upsetting. And unfortunately, it's something that again, happens all too often.
Mm. Any final thoughts on your part, Dan?
Obviously, it's a terrible tragedy. It's upset Indonesia back. It was just getting over the Bali attacks. The tourism industry, which is faltering, is again going to take another hammer blow from this. You know, and it is senseless. And you do ask yourself, especially if you've seen it enough times, you know, towards what end is all this? But I guess that's rather banal.
Are authorities speculating, concluding that this was actually targeting the U.S.?
They are, and I think to a certain extent it was. Usually have is casting layers of targets. They're both have to go after the U.S. They're also after to happy to attack, a symbol of government and power in Indonesia. And then they'll say whoever died was probably an infidel and they deserved it. At least this has been the history when people have been caught involved with the Jemaah Islamiyah and Islam attacks in Indonesia. You ask them why, and they'll give you a list of 15 or 18 different reasons. And among them will be because, they thought they'd be able to kill Americans. So I do believe that it was no coincidence that it was this hotel. But I also believe that to imagine it, it's only about going after Americans. Again, loses some of the fact that the overwhelming number of victims of these types of attacks aren't Americans and are never Americans. They're the people that live in these countries.
Dan Murphy, correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor in Jakarta, Indonesia, author of a three-part series entitled How Al-Qaeda Lit the Bali Fuse. While the man who wrote The People's History of the United States, noted historian Howard Zinn, offers this commentary about the war on Iraq. It's entitled Victory.
The so-called victory over an already devastated and disarmed Iraq led Bush, Rumsfeld, and their teammates into a locker room frenzy of exultation and self-congratulation. I half expected to see Bush joyfully pouring beer on Rumsfeld's head and Ashcroft snapping a towel at Ari Fleischer's derriere. But it turns out that the war did not bring order to Iraq, but chaos. Not crowds of cheering Iraqis, but widespread hostility. No to Saddam, no to Bush were the signs. As Iraqis contemplated their ruined historic treasures, their destroyed homes, and the graves of their dead, thousands and thousands of civilians and soldiers, with many more men, women, children wounded, an ugly occupation. I see a headline, U.S. troops kill 70 in Iraqi crackdown. With each passing day, the Bush administration's lies are being exposed. There were the lies about war being necessary to destroy Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. But an American army of 200,000 moving aggressively throughout the country cannot find them. The only weapons of mass destruction in Iraq have been the bombs and missiles raining down by the thousands, the cluster bombs spewing out their deadly pellets, the arsenal of the greatest military power on earth visiting destruction on a country ruled by a murderous tyrant, but militarily helpless. There were the lies about wanting self-determination for the Iraqis as the new officialdom, headed by wealthy exiles, was flown into positions of power. Through all this, there is a sinking feeling that most Americans remain ignorant of these things and so still support George Bush by a decisive majority. But consider how volatile is public opinion, how it can change and has done so many times with dramatic suddenness. A bit of historical perspective reminds us that governments that seem to be in total control of guns, of money, of the minds of the population, find that all their power is futile against the power of an aroused citizenry. The leaders awake one morning to see a million angry people in the streets of the capital city, and they begin packing their bags and calling for a helicopter. This is not a fantasy, but history. It's a history of the Philippines, Indonesia, Russia, East Germany, Poland, Hungary, Romania, and other places where change looked hopeless, and then it happened. Throughout history, imperial powers gloating over victories become overextended and overconfident as their citizens begin to get uneasy because their day-to-day fundamental needs are being sacrificed for military glory while their young are being sent to die in wars. The uneasiness grows and grows, and the citizenry gather in resistance in larger and larger numbers, and one day the top-heavy empire falls over. We don't expect Bush to scurry off in a helicopter, but he can lose the next election, just as he lost the last one. And this time, perhaps not all the king's judges or all the king's men will be able to put Humpty Dumpty together again. And there are already people around the country calling for his impeachment. Of course, we do not expect a craven Congress to impeach him. They were willing to impeach Nixon for breaking into a building. They will not impeach Bush for breaking into a country. They were willing to impeach Clinton because of his sexual shenanigans, but they will not impeach Bush for his pandering to the super rich. Still, it's good to bring up impeachment because the Constitution allows it for, quote, high crimes and misdemeanors, unquote. And so it's an opportunity to discuss the high crimes of this government. The change in public opinion starts with a low-level discontent, at first vague, with no connection being made to the policies of the government. And then, as some connections become unmistakable, indignation rises and people begin to speak out, to organize, to act. The arrogance, the posturing of this administration is becoming more and more hollow as its lies become exposed. Its victory in Iraq a sham, its tax program an obvious theft by the rich. The rest of the planet, and remember we in the United States are only 4% of the world population, views this nation not as a liberator but as a marauder.
Historian Howard Zinn, author of The People's History of the United States. U.S. military casualties incurred during the occupation of Iraq have been more than twice as high as most Americans have been led to believe, reports yesterday's London Guardian. An extraordinarily high number of accidents and suicides have gone, for the most part unreported in the media. And while 52 American soldiers have been killed by hostile fire since the official end of the war on May 1st, the total number of U.S. deaths is 112. The paper also reports that 827 military personnel have been wounded since the start of the war. On the Iraqi side, the website IraqBodyCount.net estimates close to 7,000 civilian casualties as a result of the war, and frustration with the U.S. occupation is continuing to fester. Former U.N. Weapons Inspector Scott Ritter predicted before the war that the U.S. would prevail militarily, but it would still lose the war in the end and leave Iraq, quote, with its tail between its legs, unquote. Ritter revisited his prediction recently when he spoke at a press conference hosted by Sonny Miller, executive director of the Trap Rock Peace Center in Western Massachusetts.
The analogy that I've used many times is that of Afghanistan and the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, where they were able to successfully take Kabul, take the palace, take every major urban center in Afghanistan, and yet after nearly 10 years, they left Afghanistan with their tail between their legs. They got beat. Because war isn't simply a matter of putting troops on the ground and closing with and destroying the enemy through firepower maneuver. War is an extension of politics. We have an objective in Iraq of liberating Iraq. You can't liberate a people that don't want to be liberated. Whatever honeymoon period we might have had in the aftermath of the demise of Saddam Hussein's regime has long since passed. The people that are resisting us in Iraq today are not only the supporters of Saddam Hussein, but also people who are in opposition to Saddam Hussein. We are a few moments away, whether you measure it in days, weeks, or a month, from the Shia community, 60% of the population, rejecting the American occupation of Iraq and declaring a fatwa, or religious edict, calling for a jihad. When we have 60% of the population turn against us, we're not going to be losing Americans at the rate of one or two a day. We're going to lose them at a rate of 5, 6, 10, 20 a day. You can't win a war that's unwinnable. What is the purpose of this war? Is it to occupy Iraq? How long will the American people put up with this? We already see that the public chafing at the bit about the fact that although Bush declared the war over on 1 May, we're still very much involved in ongoing combat operations. Rumsfeld has said that we're going to be rotating troops out, not rotating occupation troops, rotating combat troops. We're going to withdraw the 3rd Division. We're going to put in another combat division. Why? Because we're still at war in Iraq. We haven't won this war. We're not going to win this war. And that's exactly what I meant by that statement.
Diane Brancaccio of The Recorder here in Greenfield. Do you have a question, Diane?
What clout does the UN have to take any kind of action?
The UN has no clout whatsoever. The UN, the United Nations is a collection of sovereign states. It's a club. And the UN only works if all members of the club agree to abide by the rules. As long as the United States maintains its current policy of global domination in total disregard to international law, the United Nations has no viability whatsoever. The United Nations can only be viable if the United States wants to be a meaningful member. And the analogy I like to have Americans reflect on is at the end of the Revolutionary War, George Washington was the head of the Continental Army. He's a man who had just evicted the British. And a grateful Continental Army gave him the opportunity to be king of America. They said, the power is yours. One man, be our king. When George III, the King of England, heard of this, he said, if Washington rejects this, he's the greatest man in history. And you know, Washington did reject that. He stepped away from total power, and he gave power to the people of America. Today, the United States has total power. There is not a nation or group of nations in the world that can match us militarily or economically. And now we're at a decision that we, the people, have to make. Do we step forward and assume the mantle of absolute power, total domination of the globe, in disregard to the United Nations, or do we step back and transfer this power to the global community? If we reject the power, we're the greatest nation the world's ever seen. We'll be the first nation to ever stand up to that test and pass it. If, as it appears we're going to do, we assume the mantle of absolute power, we're going to go down in history as just another empire. You know, when all empires die of the same disease, indigestion. They try and consume the world, and the world consumes them. So the American people really do have a fundamental decision to make in November 2004. Where do we go as a people?
Bob Paquette, news director of WFCR in Amherst, Massachusetts. Do you have a question?
Very early on, you talked about 96 of the buildings that were bombed were part of the inspection process. In other words, part of the buildings that you were involved in inspecting. Do you come away from this feeling that you were aiding and abetting in that bombing effort because of the work you were doing back then?
Let's go back to 91. The Iraqis lied. The Iraqis held on to weapons they weren't supposed to have. The Iraqis put in place a mechanism of concealment. I was brought in as an intelligence officer to break through that wall of concealment and find out where they were hiding the weapons. Get a United Nations phone book and look up the intelligence service of the United Nations. You won't find one. So I was brought in to create a capability that the United Nations didn't have the wherewithal to sustain or support. It is totally correct for a United Nations organization to turn to member states for assistance. So when I go to the CIA with the permission of the United Nations and enter into a relationship with the CIA, I'm doing it to support a resolution calling for the disarmament of Iraq. The CIA, however, has a different mandate. So the CIA is carrying out its own secret war, which is to get rid of Saddam Hussein. I go into Iraq, I gather information, that information makes it back, not because the CIA is stealing it from the inspectors, we're giving it to them. Why? Because we're engaged in a process of joint cooperation. They give me a lead, I investigate the lead, I bring the lead back, I sit down with their analysts, and we flesh it out. I take away from that which sustains disarmament. They take away from that which sustains their policy. Was I used? Yes. Did I know I was being used? Yes. And that's why I fought the CIA from day one. The CIA wanted to be the sole vehicle for passing U.S. intelligence to the United Nations. If we walk away from the CIA, we walk away from the United States government, which means we lose our political base and we can't work in Iraq without the U.S. government. All I could do is ensure that everything I was involved in, everything my inspectors were involved in, pertained to disarmament. It's up to the members of the United Nations. It's up to the members of the Security Council. It's up to the United States to make sure that when it says it supports a disarmament process, that is what it supports. That's why I'm very critical of Congress for not stepping forward and saying, what is it we want to do in Iraq? Congress says we supported a resolution to disarm. Then why does Congress turn around and support a domestic resolution to remove Saddam Hussein from power? Congress, make up your mind. Where do you want to go? I can't make that decision. As a weapons inspector, I'm an implementer of the mandate of the council. I did so in a fair, objective, and balanced fashion.
What happens when the Bush administration eventually gets to the point when it's been asked so often about weapons of mass destruction and where are they and where are they, that they finally turn and say, are the American people safer now than they were before Saddam Hussein was in power? Are the Iraqi people better off than they were?
Well, let's take that one step at a time. Are the American people better off today than they were when Saddam Hussein was under power? During the period of nonviolence, and remember, we were always at war with Iraq. We bombed Iraq in the no-fly zones, etc. How many American troops came home in body bags? It's a simple question to ask. None. Americans are dying on almost a daily basis right now. Around the world, we are vilified. We are hated. We are engendering, you know, responses that will manifest themselves violently in the future. No, America's not safer today than we were before the invasion. We're at greater risk because we've walked away. Not only are we killing Americans, remember, it's not Iraqis killing Americans. It's President Bush that's killing Americans. He put them in harm's way. This was an elective war. This isn't a defensive war. This isn't storming the beach at Omaha to go in and rid the world of Nazi Germany that declared war on us, or to go into Okinawa and get rid of fascist Japan who bombed Pearl Harbor. This is an elective war. We chose to go to war. We aren't defending ourselves. We're waging an illegal war of aggression. So we're to blame for the deaths of not just Americans, but Iraqis. And remember, it's not just the Iraqis that are dying as a result of this war. What about economic sanctions? Americans tend to have forgotten about economic sanctions. Well, there's 1.5 million Iraqis who died during economic sanctions, and their families aren't forgetting it. Why did we starve these people to death? Why did we subject them to malnutrition and disease? Because Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. That's what we used to sustain the economic sanctions. We now know that was a lie. So who is to blame for the death of the Iraqi people? Not just the ongoing deaths and the deaths that are going to occur in the future, but the ones in the past. 1.5 million. The blood is on the hands of the United States of America. Now, you could probably make a case that George Herbert Walker Bush didn't have all the data necessary, so he kept sanctions moving forward. Okay, President Clinton up until 1995 maybe sustained that policy because he didn't have the data. After 1995, there was no excuse on the part of any administration, any government official, to say that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction that pose a threat to the United States of America. Iraq has weapons of mass destruction that justify the continuation of sanctions that we know are only killing innocent civilians. They have nothing to do with impeding the president of Iraq, Saddam Hussein. I think we'll go down in history as a quasi-genocidal act carried out by the United States in pursuit of a policy of regime removal that's illegal. There's a reason why Thomas Jackson, the Supreme Court justice, stared German politicians and generals in the face in 1946 and said, "You're going to die." He found them guilty. Guilty of what? Waging a war of aggression. He said, "You know, you're before us not because you lost the war, but because you started the war." And the United States, by invading Iraq in March of this year, puts ourselves on the same page of history as the Germans when they invaded Poland in 1939 and as Saddam Hussein when he invaded Kuwait in August 1990. And American people need to ask themselves, is that the page that we want our history written on?
Former U.N. Weapons Inspector Scott Ritter speaking at a recent press conference with Sonny Miller, Executive Director of the Trap Rock Peace Center in Western Massachusetts. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.